Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thunder Athletes, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Now, I'm sure you've seen the news by now. Rebellion are opening their own film and TV studio just outside of Oxford. Didcot, it's a $100 million facility where we're going to be filming not just the Rogue Trooper movie and the Judge Dredd TV show, but also lots of third-party productions. There's a huge shortage of production space in the UK at the moment. So really exciting times for 2000 AD and Rebellion. We'll be touching more on this news in later episodes. But yeah, check out the news on the 2000 AD website and we'll bring you more about the exciting future of 2000 AD film and TV in future episodes. You may also have seen some of the buzz online about Judge Dredd, The Small House by Rob Williams and Henry Flint, with colour by Chris Blythe and letters by Annie Parkhouse. This is a series that's really set the internet alight. People seem to be enjoying this incredibly. I mean, it's a complex tale of conspiracy, and there's action in there, and it's all these plot threads coming together from the past 10 years. You've got Dirty Frank, you've got Dredd, you've got Judge Smiley, you've got Judge Hershey. Lots of jaw-dropping moments in this series, and it's great to see so much positive feedback from not just Squawkstick Thargo, but also comics reviewers and critics. So this is the ideal time, as the story wraps up, to begin our interview with artist Henry Flint. Now, Henry has been working for 2000 AD for a number of years. He started with us on Rogue Trooper back in the 1990s, but in the last sort of 10 years has really become one of the definitive Judge Dredd artists, certainly, in my humble opinion, to stand alongside the greats such as Scala, McMahon, Bolland, Ron Smith, and others. And it's wonderful to have seen his style develop into something quite unique. So Henry and I sat down and had a good long chat, which we'll be bringing you over the next two episodes. Don't forget, if there's an artist or writer or a subject that you'd like to see covered on the 2000 AD Thrillcast, please do drop us a line at thrillcast@2000ad.com. That's all one word, thrillcast@2000ad.com, and we'll do the best that we can. And you know, do us a favour and go on to iTunes or your favourite podcast app and give us a review, preferably 5 stars, and tell us what you love about the 2000 AD Thrillcast, the galaxy's greatest podcast. Now, without much further ado, let's crack on as we meet the artist who has become one of the 21st century's defining Judge Dredd artists, Henry Flint. I kind of want to start off by talking about The Small House, which obviously is still running in the prog at this point in time, so we'll be light on the spoilers because you've just delivered the last episode of that, haven't you?
Yes. I delivered the last episode. It was episode 10, but it was right on the deadline, and I think there was is already up to issue 7,
yeah,
or 6 or 7 in the comic, so yeah. Bit scary stuff.
Is that normal? Do you normally run the deadlines, or
No, I asked Matt for the deadlines because it helps me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I kind of get to a point where I spend too much time, especially if it's the summer and the sun's out and everything. The time can just go, and I can spend a day where I just don't do any work at all. So I kind of need the deadlines to give myself incentive to do it. Yeah.
With The Small House itself, I mean, there's been a lot of really great feedback on the story. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of the story, because you've worked with Rob quite a lot now. You worked with the team on Trifecta, so Al, Cyan, and Rob, and then you did Titan and Enceladus. Mm-hmm. And you're now doing The Small House. Mm-hmm.
Are the ideas for these something that you discuss with Rob or...?
No. These are ideas that Rob's come up without me interfering at all. Mm. I mean, it's his thing, and I only know what I'm doing when Matt sends me a script that Rob's been doing, and I take a look, and it's usually the first episode. Mm. So I get the first episode in, and that is all I have to judge the entire series. And usually I'm in the same position as the reader, so I'm kind of in a position where I read the script and I think, oh, okay, where is this going to go? Mm. And I don't know where it's going to go, and so I'm completely in the dark. And Rob's, got me as a reader at the same time, but I like that because it keeps me wanting to know what happens next,
So when you've got that first episode, like you say, you've got to make that value judgment kind of immediately how the whole thing is gonna pan out. Mm. Has there been a time that you've been progressing through a strip and you've thought, crap, I've got this completely wrong?
Yeah, a few times. I couldn't give you any examples offhand, but I think it was worse a few years ago. Well, when I first started, there was a time I wouldn't read the entire script first. I'd read a page and then draw the page and then read the next page, and that has so many problems because you just end up drawing you'd read the next page and it would say someone does something which needs him to be carrying something which you didn't realise he's carrying, or that kind of thing, and you just think, oh, I've got to redo this and that. But I think it was talking to other comic creators. They did prelims, and that was something that I didn't do as well.
Right.
So I've only been doing that for the last 10 years, and before that, I just didn't do prelims. It was just going straight into the pencils, but I can't say I could ever go back, because doing prelims is essentially the brain work of the whole thing. It's where you do all the work, and the rest, you can listen to the radio and just let your mind wander a bit. But that full concentration of the prelims, that's quite an important part of the process.
I mean, that's remarkable. It just never occurred to you to do that.
No, it didn't. I didn't know people did it, to be honest.
Right.
I think there was a book, there was this American artist, is it John Burns or someone like that? And his prelims were wonderful. He brought a little book out or something. I thought, that's interesting.
That seems like a useful thing to do.
Yeah, and then, but he was using them, he would scale them up. Using one of these machines, and he would use the prelims as a pencils, rough pencils.
Yeah,
and that was something that I perhaps. I don't have one of those machines. I probably would if it would do it that method, because sometimes the prelims come out better than the actual real work.
Yeah,
sometimes. Sometimes,
because it's sliding the scale. You have. I hope I'm not going to slander him here. Somebody like PJ Holden, whose prelims are quite rough, and just kind of indication of action.
Yeah. Mine are as well. Right. He's literally stick figures.
You've got the other end of the scale, which is Dylan Teague, who's. Prelims, and I'm doing the rabbit ear thing in the air, because they're not prelims, they're full pencils, on a very small scale.
Yeah, and he uses those wonderful markers and just gets everything looking great. Mine are just so rough that you can't really make out, and they're all covered in writing, and there's There's little arrows saying, you know, not enough space here and things like that. And it's all in artistic shorthand, you know, so only I know what's going on. Right.
Coming back to the small house, so you didn't know the reveal, you didn't know the sort of ending reveal, that's probably the wrong word, the ending of the story.
No, I didn't.
Do you think that helps? Because you say that you refer to yourself as a reader while you're doing that process. Do you think that actually helps that you get the timing of it?
Yeah.
In a certain way.
Yeah, how do you mean? Sort of the timing of the...
The timing of how you portray time within the strip, because yes. you're... Yeah. Discovering it as you go along.
Yeah.
Have you? I mean, I don't know. Have you got more of an acute sense of the highs and the lows?
No, I think that's something that the writer knows. Mm. I mean, the writer always talks about. I'm trying to think of the terminology they use, but it's things like punch points or something.
Sure.
That type of thing. I've got the word wrong, but. Not bullet points. There's something that they talk, but it's the way the story moves, and it goes boom, boom, boom. Yeah. Beats. That's it. And that is really a writer thing, and I don't think I can portray that artistically. Mm. It's just a matter of having confidence with the writer that they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm concerned, that my beats usually go for which is the biggest panel of the page, and that will have more of an impact on the way I tell a story and the way that things sort of pan out. Mm. That comes from. That's right, the birth of 2000D, isn't it? Where it was the first, not the first comic, but before 2000D, that they had about 13, 14 panels per page in British comics. And I think it was Pat Mills that looked at the American comics, to know something like Thor or something, I heard. I remember hearing in an interview, he said, and thinking, right, there's 6 or 7 panels, we'll do that format, and then one of those panels will be a big splash, and I kind of kept that ethos, thinking, yeah, that's a good way to do it, because 6 panels is, you can't equally have 6 panels on a page, because it just looks a bit threadbare. There's so much room, and the pages on 2000D are so big that you can afford to shrink down some of these panels really quite small, and just to give another panel a really big epic feel. You know, that's
it's something I've noticed about the small house is your use of panel sizes and location and how often. You'll place them over the top of other panels. So quite often I noticed also on your Dread movie tie-in work, there'll be the big splash panel which goes out behind the other panels. It is essentially the page upon which the other panels are placed. And that you seem to use that to make panels punchier. I'm thinking the moment, and anyone who's not read The Small House needs to stop listening now and go and read it, but the moment where Dredd turns to Hershey and says, I no longer recognise your authority, that panel of Hershey in shock, you've essentially lifted that off the page almost.
Yeah, there's about 3 or 4 pictures after that, that are the aftermath of what Dredd actually says. And they're all pictures, the splash pictures placed over the top of the main picture of Dredd. Mm. So it's kind of like, yeah, Dredd says this needs to be the big panel, and the one that has the importance is the establishing shot, if you like, establishing what Dredd is saying, you know. And then you have the just the reaction shots that just over the top. I think that's something that Frank Miller did a lot in his early 80s work. That was something that I caught my eye. He used to do little tiny panels, but with just a little tiny face in them, and then the balloons wouldn't even be in the panels; they'd be pointing at the panels,
yeah,
or something like that. I thought that's nice. That just looks interesting, and coming up with things like that, anything to break up the page and make the page look slightly different, and just having fun with it, I think it's important. Yeah, and I think small houses. I mean, it surprised me. Mm. I've kind of I wasn't even aware of what was going on. I think Rob said, "Yeah, this will be a good one. This will be we've got a few surprises in this one." I think he told me. I went, okay. but you go into it thinking that's just another job.
Yeah,
you're not really thinking anything else, and then you start getting into the story, and then you turn the page, and then you realise, oh no, what's happened here? You know, I won't spoil anything, but yeah. You know, there's a few moments where I'll just turn the page, and I usually go down to Witherspoon's, my local 5 minutes walk away, and that's where I read the script. I print out, read the script, and do the prelims in the pub,
right,
with a coffee and free coffee top ups. and spend a few hours in there, and I was verbally giving some kind of outwardly verbal moments,
yeah,
where I'm sure people around me were going, oh right, what's going on there, and it's just me reading the script and I was going no. It's great.
How invested do you get when you're doing a script as it's being revealed to you by the writer?
Yeah, because it's a completely different time, because the reader reads it, I don't know how long the reader takes to read it, but you're reading something over the space of 6 months or so, and then you're spending so much time, so it's like everything is happening in slow motion, and it's like everything is just winding very slow, so someone's emotion will just last a couple of days almost, as opposed to just a reader flashing through it on a page, and it's yeah, you kind of just get wrapped up in it, and I suppose it's melodrama, isn't it? It's that all those things, and it's going to be quite exciting. Really? Yeah.
One of the early kind of, well, the earliest kind of what the fuck moment in the Small House was that wonderful page where Smiley turns to Dredd and says, we're fascists.
Yes.
Now, having spoken to Rob about that, the use of the big splash image of Dredd, that Smiley's not even in that panel, was your choice.
Was it my choice?
That's what he told me.
Oh, right. I can't remember what it said in the script, but I kind of think he said something like a Dredd close-up over half the page.
Right.
He said, but I can't remember whether he included Smiley there or it said Smiley point of view. He might have said that. I can't remember, to be honest. But no, I thought it was just him. It was just Dredd. I wasn't sure that Smiley was included in that one.
But it's one of those moments of, I mean, high emotion. That nobody reading that can miss the fact that.
Well, he said it in the script. He said this is a big moment. so he said, make sure you know, make sure you have some impact.
Yeah.
You know. So I thought, oh, right, okay. So when you got things like that in the script from Rob, you know, you don't really have to work too hard on doing the drawing.
Here was me going to ask all these questions about how you trust each other. I was just like, yeah, put this in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Rob's got an incredible way of writing, you see, because he uses emotion and things in his the way he delivers. So it's rather than giving a technical, detailed where everyone's standing or where the camera should be shot. He just talks about how the characters are feeling.
Right, okay.
And that really gets you involved, and you're just thinking, oh, right, how best do I tell this story if this character is feeling like this?
Yeah.
You know, and that is a completely different way of telling a story than John Wagner, who will just kind of just say, this is where Dredd is, you know, Dredd, and that's it. That will be all he'll say, and leave the rest to you. But this... So, you know, there's different ways of doing a story. There isn't a right or wrong, and Rob's is I really enjoy writing Rob's scripts. I think he has something that it's just really interesting to read. Simple as that, really.
I mean, which do you prefer? Do you prefer the Wagnerian?
Well, the Wagner one, you don't really need to know how people are feeling, because the Wagner scripts that I've been getting are comedy scripts. So you don't need to know how people are feeling most of the time. It's just who's in the shot, and that's the most important thing. So you can the comedy comes out a lot more when you're using where everything is quite basic in its storytelling approach. He does have a John is quite minimal in the way that he gives the instructions, but of course there's quite a lot of dialogue. He uses a lot of dialogue. So it's if no one was telling me who was writing which script and I got a script in, I could probably tell who was writing it quite easily. Rob's emotional, John Wagner's minimalist, and Al is surreal. I'm trying to think of other writers now, but those are the few that I've been working.
How invested are you in Dredd as a character? Is he a character you've always wanted to draw?
I haven't always wanted to draw him. He wasn't. I read 2000 since the beginning, and he wasn't my first favourite script in 2000D, and I never really thought I'd ever be drawing in 2000D at all. But Dredd is... I was given the opportunity to draw Dredd quite early on, and I didn't really think that that would happen, to be honest, and I kind of taken to it, and the character has taken to me, and I kind of made it work, but in no way was it any kind of ambition to draw Dredd.
Okay, so when I've interviewed people in the past, they've always sort of cited their influences, but it's always tended to be people who've had an eye on drawing him. So what are your influences? Was it a process whereby those influences were latent, you know, I'll just draw on these? Or did you go, oh crap, I've got to draw Dredd? Who from this smorgasbord of styles do I draw from?
I had my favourite artists were McMahon and Bolland and Square and all the greats from the early 2000 and Bonelli and O'Neill as well, and those were the ones that I've been brought up on. It's difficult to say the influences, because I don't think there's a lot of influence comes out of It must do, though. But I think it's subconsciously. It comes from all these different artists. Mm. And more to do with 2000 artists than, say, a DC or Marvel type artist. Although I probably was more influenced by people in Europe.
Mm.
I was a big fan of Heavy Metal magazine and the Metal Hurlant, the original in the 70s, and I managed to get myself a couple of copies of that. And with Mobius and those characters, and I think it's sort of a mishmash of all those different characters. But you see, with Judge Dredd, it's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say it because it's difficult, because you have to sort of delve into your own head and see where you've come from. But what I'm trying to think where it has come from. And I think what I really enjoy doing the most is inventing new characters and drawing new things. And that gets me a lot more excited. Well, when I'm drawing Dredd, I know it's a character that's already existed.
Mm.
And I think it was polished up. McMahon sort of took Dredd and took the character and moulded him into something a bit different to its original Carlos sort of creation. And I thought, well, I can't really mould him any further, because I think, was it Brendan McCarthy? Sort of, he took the character even further, but by having the flared helmet and things like that. And you could see that this direction that Dredd could go if other artists picked up on it, but yeah. I don't think many artists did. But I thought, well, I'm going to have to, if I've got to base my Dredd on anything, it's going to be McMahon and Bolland Dredd, because those got it. It doesn't need improving.
Yeah,
and there's no artist from the 90s I can think of that took it Dredd any further than McMahon and Bolland. I could be wrong. I'm trying to think if there was one. Simon Bisley did a Heavy Metal Dredd. That was, that was interesting. But I think it was a full stop. Only Bisley could draw like that. And then it got quite. There's a few painterly Dredds in the 90s, and that also is a artistic stop. I don't think that has been progressed. It's McMahon and Bolland, really.
Because I saw a lot of Scala in Titan, particularly in the scenes where Dredd's essentially being tortured and beaten up. And that it kind of struck me that kind of, how to describe it, gritty bluntness is a kind of a Scala quality I see in your stuff. At no time do you seem to be disguising.
I like that. Esquerra said something. He said he prefers drawing Mega City 1 grim and gritty rather than nice and shiny and chrome and sparkling. And he really gets into all the pipes and the grime and just dirt and rubbish everywhere. And I kind of agree. It's much more interesting to draw. When you have Dredd beaten up as he was on Titan, and you kind of think, yeah, this is the bit where, I think it comes from the those films, Clint Eastwood films with the Man with No Name. I think there was one of them where he was just really was beaten up. I think it was I think it was Fistful of Dollars or something, I could be wrong, a few dollars more, and he was beaten up, and And then it's that point where you just think, ah, there's no other way. He's there's no other way for this character to act. He's got to get up on his feet and he's got to beat these guys, because this is the story now. And I love those moments. You know, just you know, someone will write me the fact that Dredd's been beaten up and he's in a bad way, and I just think, yeah, let's really go to town. Let's really make Dredd in a bad way.
Yeah.
And so his ultimate redemption of getting better and beating the bad guys just is even better.
Because that's happened a few times through his history. I mean, you know, the Cursed Earth is the obvious early one.
Yeah.
City of the Damned. Even stuff like, do you remember when Stan Lee's daughter? It was in the 90s, where it was painted by John Burns.
Oh, right.
And she came back and sort of tortured Dredd under the city, and that was a similar kind of thing where she was like, eventually.
He was kept in a cage or something.
Yeah, he was like bound up and
for quite a few weeks or something. That was a strange story.
I love the fact that, what was it, he encouraged the rats to come and chew on the bindings because they were covered in his blood, and then, I don't know, he either broke the neck of the rat or he bit it or something. Okay, that's fine.
It's great. Yeah,
but you're right, it's that kind of how far, because I mean, Rob's talked about this in terms of Titan.
Yes,
you know, how far can you push a man of principle?
Yeah, yeah. And usually it's quite far, and the breaking point is quite far. I mean, City of the Damned, he went blind, didn't he? So that it was dealing with all that. But yeah, it's trying to find another angle on how broken you can break someone. Oh my goodness! But yeah, Dredd gets broken up, doesn't he? But his character is someone that you kind of aspire to, that no matter what happens, he will get through whatever people are throw at him, so and not make a fuss. There was another point in one of the Judge Dredd annuals where there's at the flea pit where everyone's covered in fleas, and someone says, "Well, why aren't you getting bitten by fleas?" And he says, I am. Yeah. I'm just not scratching." And I think that is Dredd all over. Because it's just so says, yeah, he deals with the pain. He sort of buries everything. His humanity just buries everything down, so no one can see who he is, what he is, and even his pain. No, he won't even. The readers don't even know what pain he's going through, because he sort of doesn't show it. He'll just say, grit his teeth and get through it.
Because that's some of the yours and Rob's work has touched on is. How brittle that makes him as a character, and actually how when it comes to, because he's an expression of Justice Department, he is the big faceless fascist boot boy who has no emotion. But yeah, that does make him vulnerable to cracking as opposed to breaking, as it were.
Yeah. He has cracked on a few occasions, hasn't he? Yeah.
Well, in terms of how you portray him, what are the kind of elements of that portrayal? So, do you consciously or intuitively have him stand a certain way, look a certain way, hold himself a certain way?
In a kind of way that he. At those points where he's breaking, there is a lot of body language that you can use, especially when it's you're not talking about the dialogue so much, and it won't come through in Dredd's dialogue. He won't So you have to express and to the reader how Dredd is feeling, not through his words, but through how he's holds his own body, mm-hmm. you know, and if you can sort of slunch him over a tiny bit and make him look as though he's run into a brick wall, even better. I mean, he does on occasion, a lot of occasions, does. He needs help, doesn't he? Yeah, I don't know how to describe it. It's like trying to, and I've never analysed Dredd, to be honest. And you, it's interesting to sort of take this character, because he's not like the American superheroes, is he? He's completely different, and he doesn't let anger so much. I mean, there's the anger is written into the story all the time. Rob says, right, Dredd is really angry now, but I kind of think, yeah, he's angry, but it's kind of like a it's a strange anger that doesn't give away any of his character.
Well, it's suppressed, isn't it?
It's suppressed anger. Up, yeah. Yeah. He's gritting his teeth, but he's keeping control. So the anger's there, but the control, he hasn't lost it. He hasn't lost the control. Mm.
Because there's that lovely moment in that first or second episode of The Small House where Smiley says something and Dredd clearly forms a fit, like his hand involuntarily just kind of clenches, and you used that little motif almost like a little star, just as a moment of action. I quite like that.
Oh, right, yes.
Do you remember doing that?
I can't remember doing that, to be honest with you. It might have been written in the script,
right?
Rob might have said, yeah, he forms a fist or something like that. Yeah. I like that little motifs and putting little things in.
Because one of the things I noticed that you share with an artist like Arthur Ransom, for example, is a great appreciation of silence as a means of controlling the flow of time in a page. So when Ransom was doing Button Man, for example, he would insert silent panels into the strip to measure out the amount of time, well, the passage of time on the page when he thought it was going too quickly. And certainly in your Judge Dredd work, that seems to be a feature as well, where you've got a lot of times when the panel is focusing on Dredd not saying anything, not doing anything, he's being very still. Again, is that something you consciously do? Is it something from the script?
Sometimes I don't do it so much with Rob's work. There's been a couple of times I've added a few panels here and there with Rob. I mean, one of them was the reaction shots of the in the recent one, where Dredd says, I've lost, what did he say?
I no longer recognise your authority.
Yeah, and with all those panels, and all I did was add a little, it was just that one of the visor, but the only reason I added that was because there's a big empty space there. I do add panels here and there. Yeah. When I mean, that was a purely page format reason why I added one. So that was a bit naughty of me to do that. But I do add them when I think it is necessary to.
You see, I love that. One of the things I enjoy about comics is how practical considerations can inadvertently impact storytelling.
Yeah, and the big one is the square panels. If you do a square panel, the only other panel that can go next to a square panel is another square panel. So that can really alter the way that you design a page. So nice long elongated panels are good and things like that. But yeah, and it seems to telling stories you have to get the page right at the beginning. Mm. I mean, because that's where all the brain work happens, you know. That's
it's every art form has elements that are forced upon it by the nature of the physical object. So novels have to work in a certain way, short stories have to work in a certain way, comic books very much have to work in a certain way. And we kind of touched on already, but I wanted to see what you thought about how much what you do is gut instinct, intuitive, and how much of the thinking you do when you're doing your prelims now. how much you're consciously going, well, that needs to go there, that needs to go there, or whether it's coming out of the pencil in your hand rather than.
It is a lot of it is intuitive. A lot of it is trying to. It's like a puzzle, and there's so many different elements. You've got to get the story right. You've got to be aware that the reader is reading it, and you don't want to confuse the reader too much. But if the story is really simple, and it's a simple story, then you've got the luxury of making it even more complicated.
Mm.
So by adding more panels or making the angles slightly and going a bit more arty, but as long as it's coherent, and that's the main thing you're looking for is a coherent story. So you got that to consider, and then you got the limitation of the page. So you've got to think about where the best use of the page and how to cram everything in without but also making sure that you don't have any blank spaces, you don't have any sort of spaces there that needs things to go in. You know, you've got to make use of everything, and then there's the balloons, where the balloons go, because the balloons have to not cross. They've got you've got to have the right
first speaker on the left.
Yeah, first speaker on the left. But that's not always the case. Mm. Sometimes it's not the first speaker on the left. It's the last speaker on the right, because you've got more than one speech balloon coming from someone, and then you've got a reply coming from someone else, which means the last person has to be on the right. And it usually doesn't make any sense when you look at it and you think, well, why is that person there? And so there's that to consider. There's how much space does the balloons, I mean, someone that uses very minimal amount of text like Rob it is interesting, because you've got so much more space to play with John Wagner's you've got to really, really concentrate, because I mean, there's so much dialogue. It's often two or three, four people talking all over each other, and you just need space for this dialogue to go. But yeah, I've picked up some interesting tips. things like if you have a character, you can have a nice long panel where the head is at the top and the body covers the entire panel, so you're not wasting any space. So if you've got a massive amount of text, all that text can go over the body with the head at the top. So it looks nice, rather than having a little head at the bottom of the panel and a big empty space above the head for the lettering to go. So that's a good tip.
Yeah.
It's you can draw the bodies and allow text to go over the bodies, and I think that's a people shouldn't be afraid of having their artwork being covered over.
Because you've been working in comics for
94.
All right, okay. So that was about 25 years.
Yeah, that's with 2000 AD.
Yeah.
But before that, there was a couple of years with other comics as well.
How much, therefore, of what you do now is just sheer experience of having done it for that long? Because noting that you've only done prelims for about 10 years.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think it's a learning process all the time, because I kind of get the script. Sometimes I get the script and I think, I don't know how to handle this.
Mm.
And it needs some really, you need to think about it quite a lot, because it's almost like you're learning from scratch, and this will be the job that you work on that you can't figure out how to do it anymore. Mm. I have learned and picked up a lot of tips, and my figure work at the beginning, especially in the 90s, was dreadful. I look back on some of that stuff and think, wow, yeah, I actually have improved quite a bit on the figure work.
Yeah.
And faces and expressions and things like that. My work was a lot more cartoony and wooden in the olden days. And I look at that stuff and think, oh, yeah, I have made an improvement. And I wasn't as raw talent as I thought I was. Mm. I was just someone who was still learning to draw.
Yeah,
you know, and just got lucky to be offered a job when I did. Because of course, I got the job when there wasn't a lot of people in the job at the time, because they'd all gone over to work for the States and things like that. And there was a big void, there was a big gap in the 90s. So I was one of these lucky characters that sort of just went, yeah, there's a space for me. Because it was really unpopular. The 90s were unpopular for comics.
Mm.
The 80s were massive. You had, you know, obviously Watchmen and all the rest of it, Dark Knight and everything. I thought that there'd be a natural progression. That type of thing would run on throughout the 90s, but it didn't. It kind of just went into this, people call comics adult comics, and they thought, well, just because it had a few swear words in it, that would turn it into an adult comic, and it didn't. Mm. It was just, an adult comic is using your brain to interpret things. And that type of story just wasn't there in the 90s, and it kind of went to... You had all this laddism. Everyone was buying the loaded magazines and things like that, and you had all the music, Britpop, and comics were really, really unpopular. I think I remember there was one Comic Con one year, I think right in the 87 or something.
Okay.
And that was in Manchester. Mm. And then the following year, there was none. There was not a single Comic Con anywhere.
Mm.
And then it's after the 90s, it built up and to what it is today. But it was almost dead in the water, comics.
Mm. Well, it's kind of weird how it had been such a part of the zeitgeist with Deadline and Crisis. And then within 3 or 4 years...
It just disappeared.
Yeah.
I don't know where it went. It's just no one was interested anymore.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because we were a Deadline reader.
I was, yeah.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, and Crisis, and anything that 2000 brought out, really, and Dice Man as well, and just everything that they produced.
Let's sort of go right back to the beginning and talk about the comics you were reading as a kid, because that's always interesting, that's always illustrative. You've been with 2000 AD since the beginning, but were you a voracious comic book reader?
Yeah. I've often said it was the first comic that I picked up and read was Jack and Jill,
right,
when I was But
which I think we now own.
Yeah, I've even got. Can you see? I'm pointing to it now. The Jack and Jill at Amiel, 1974. And I love that. I'll show you that later because it's brilliant. It's brilliant, and the artwork in it is incredible. It's so it's like a quality publication for 4 year olds. Mm. You know, 3 or 4 year olds. And 3 or 4 years, they'd just rip up the comic, and they wouldn't appreciate it.
Yeah.
But you know, you look at that stuff and think, wow, there was, and they're probably all drawn by people who fought in World War II and things like that, and they're all drawing otters. and you know, rescuing a beach ball on the beach from someone, you know helping out a little child, and they're all doing things like that, and you just think these World War II veterans are working on these children's stories, and the poetry is just like, oh, it's gorgeous. And
so I think that's what it's either Pat or John, I think, mentions about the juvenile division at IPC or working at DC Thompson, and you know, yes, you're producing comic books for children, but these people have seen things that
they've done things that couldn't even dream about. Yeah, absolutely. So there was that. There was after that, the 70s were really good for the IPC comics, Buster, Whoopee, and. I think it was Whoopee that had I'm trying to think of the name of the worldwide weirdies.
Ken Reed,
yeah, and also in Faceache in Buster, and it was right at the tail end of his career that I kind of picked up on.
Yeah.
He was just like my favourite artist. When I was about six.
I can really see that now. I totally see it, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And in particular, the Worldwide Weirdies, it'd have like the border, which was full of spacing, with little aliens and spaceships and all these things. And I used to love that. And it used to be a different colour each week.
Yeah.
And it's just weird things like that, just the design of it. Just what colour would it be? Purple this week, great. Yeah. That looks so good in purple, that border, you know. And it would be just strange. I mean, I mean there was no computers back there, was there? That's all you had was what colour would something be printed in this week? That was my highlight. Oh dear. So it's that. Then 2000D came along, and obviously that just got me hooked, and there was what other things? I think later on, Marvel and DC American Comics, that they didn't quite get me, because round here I couldn't buy them, and I couldn't figure out where these things came from. I was aware of Batman and the rest of it, but I didn't know where these comics were bought or sold. I think it was just newsagents, but they're so tucked away I just never was able to find them. It's living down in Devon, I think, is it? But I did get into European comics and underground comics sort of in my early teens, and the whole history of that, and trying to figure out what everything was, you know, because there was a lot of information out there. There was a lot of you know, for instance, I liked the Storm, which was the Don Lawrence thing, and that was coming through. I'd buy a lot of every time I was in Amsterdam or something on a school holiday, I'd pick up some comics that were all in Dutch and I couldn't read them. But a lot of them were the Storm comics, and then there'd be other things as well. There'd be Conan, I'd buy, but that would be in French.
Yeah.
So so I couldn't read those either. But I'd just buy them for the pictures. So, and then I'd be buying the things that only were produced in France and things like that. And and the Dylan Dog, of course, and a few Italian things. I think that was Italian, I'm not sure, but I don't think there was enough choice for me in the British market, because I mean, after 2000D, British comics were sort of winding up, and there wasn't anything as good as 2000D for a start. There was perhaps some. Sorry, that's my stomach. I don't know if that you.
I didn't realise there was a dog in here.
I'm trying to think what kind of other things I was influenced with, but I think it was everything other than the American.
That's really interesting, because the vast majority of people that I talk to, you know, they read 2000 AD and they enjoyed it, but they then found either prior to 2000 AD or afterwards, they found their natural reading. Their reading naturally gravitated towards American comics, but you went.
Yeah, I just went a completely different route, and I went the European route.
Is this geographical? Is it just that's the kind of things you could access?
Well, it had a lot to do with what you could access, and there was a comic shop in Exeter at the time that would sell European reprints,
right?
In English, and there was what else was there? There was. I don't think it was up until mid-teens that I got into everything that was American stuff. Really, I'm trying to think of. Well, I was thinking of Watchmen then, but even that is a British creation, isn't it? But The Dark Knight and everything like that. I kind of. Forced myself to get into that and liked it, and thought, oh, okay, there is something out there that's produced by America that's good. But I had some favourites which I found, but they weren't probably the Batmans and everything like that, because I like Firestorm, which was this character that had atomic abilities to change things, but whenever I talk about Firestorm to other people, they kind of go, oh well, he's like a minor DC superhero. No one really picked up on it, and it's not really that good. It's great, Firestorm. He can change things atomically. What's not good about that? That's great, you know. And he had fire coming out of his head. He looked great.
Yeah.
And then another one that I really liked was Booster Gold, which no one liked. I can't find anyone.
I'm fairly sure Kieran Gillen likes Booster Gold.
and that is the weird thing. Because I thought, oh, right, this is great, Booster Gold. And I'd be reading Booster Gold and said, yeah, next month there'll be the Booster Gold. Will tell us his origin story. Oh, great! And then next month we're going to reveal Booster Gold's mobile. You know, great! That's great. And I'm thinking, and I talk about this to other people. Say, no, you don't understand it. You don't understand American comics. If that's what you think American comics are, you don't understand it. And then there was another one with what was it? I'm trying to think of all the stuff. Yeah, it was a British remake. Not a British remake, but a British reprint. And it was called The Thing is Big Ben. I don't know if you've heard of it. And it was about 20 odd issues.
Yeah.
But it was all reprinted stuff. They had Iron Man in there. And it was just Grimm, Fantastic Four, Thing. And it was his comic, but it was a British thing, and I remember buying it. I bought every issue, and I remember not liking it at the time, but buying it anyway. And I don't know. I mean, what was that about?
Because they used to do reprints of Silver Age DC stuff.
Yeah,
in British size.
Yes,
with like painted covers.
They did a lot of Spider-Man.
Yeah,
I bought the Steve Ditko thing where he lifted up the thing, and that was my first Spider-Man that I read. Was that and I never realised that that was such an iconic moment in Spider-Man's history.
It's strange if you kind of, I suppose you need to be in the right brain space. And this may be your experience, it was certainly mine, that quite a lot of American comics was such a change of pace and tone and theme from 2000 AD. I can't even go, okay. this guy I used to babysit for had a near complete collection of Uncanny X-Men. Like he had, I think his earliest issue was number 6, so right back at the beginning, and he was like, oh, you know, when you put the kids to bed, you can go up and read them. And I sit down and read a couple. I go, yeah, all right. And I just go and watch TV. I feel like such a philistine now. But if it's not your speed, then...
Yeah, no, there's a lot of things that I did like. I mean, Ronin... Mm-hmm. Frank Miller, yeah. I thought that was a graphic novel was amazing.
And that
seemed to be paced really well. I don't know what it would have read like in a comic in individual issues though, but because I'd never read the individual issues. But it's that old thing, isn't it, of 22 pages,
and you
can tell a story a lot slower. Frank Miller's stuff I did get into because you had the Daredevil. I had a few issues of that when it came out.
Do you think that's to do with the style of it? That is so stylish. It's so not unique, but very much Frank Miller.
It could be. I think it could be the way that he drew figures. It seemed to me it was getting away from drawing figures in a very that stylized superhero mold and drawing them like sketches and being really rough and raw with the pen. And I like that appealed to me
because so far it's been interesting that you mentioned Miller, you've mentioned Ken Reed, you've talked about some of the slightly greater excesses of American comics in their silliness. I see and correct me if I'm wrong, a tendency towards the more bizarre, the more surreal.
Yeah, kind of stuff. That would include Kevin O'Neill's stuff as well.
Yes, yeah.
Because that stuff, he was my favourite artist for a long time in the early 2000s. I just thought his because that was exactly it. He had a sensibility about him that was... when you look at an artist and you can't figure it out and you're just thinking, why is he... chosen this way to draw something, and the style is not complicated, but it kind of jars, and you just go, wow, he's done that. That is such a great idea, you know. What made him do that? And I like artists who do that. You know, it's like people having fun with your brain, I'm trying to think of other artists that have done the same. It's the same thing as Heath Robinson. He was another artist that when I was a kid, I had a Heath Robinson book, and it was just full of weird inventions.
Yeah,
and that did exactly the same for me. It was just pouring over the artwork, and just thinking, well, why would someone draw this? If you're going to invent something, you wouldn't do this because that's just so impractical, you know. But you only realise years later that it wasn't meant to be practical at all. It's meant to be funny.
Because you mentioned Kevin O'Neill then. I did give a wry smile when you said you had difficulty kind of working out how he did it, because of course you did have to work out how he did it because you did. The final Nemesis story finishing it off. What was that experience like?
Oh, that was really good. I think I would have done it a completely different way now. I had Kevin O'Neill in the back of my mind all the time because that was the only way that I saw Nemesis.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I could have put in a lot of my own input into Nemesis, really, and I should have. But, you know, it was a long time ago. And I think at the time I thought, well, I've got to go in this direction, because I think that this is the only way it'll work, is if I sort of try and channel Kevin O'Neill in some little way. And the easiest thing to channel him is to think of epic proportions. Mm. You think of little tiny people and everything is huge, and then you can't go far wrong. And you kind of think, because the Nemesis, everything is big, everything is huge. So I tried to sort of like do as much of that as possible. But
I mean, that must have been a pretty daunting gig.
No, it wasn't daunting at the time.
Yeah,
because it was just another gig. Mm. But like, sorry, my stomach's going. And but it's just another gig, really. But like, I think it was Andy Diggle, who was the editor at the time, said, we've got you this one, Nemesis, and I did actually think, oh wow, really? I perhaps didn't. It didn't function in my head.
Right.
That it was really And when I was reading Pat Mills' script, to be honest with you, it didn't feel like I couldn't imagine it being one of the like book one or book two. Oh, it didn't feel like it. And I thought, I'm not sure where this is coming from. I had to put a lot of work into that one, because I didn't know where it's going or what to do with it, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening, Earthlitz. Thanks very much to Henry for chatting away. That's just the first part of our about 2.5 hour long interview with Henry that took place recently. If you've not been checking out 2000 AD and Judge Dredd, The Small House, I really recommend you pick up the most recent prog, starting from prog 2100. A collection will be out in September next year. Next time on the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we plunge a bit more into Henry's career as we find out how he nearly destroyed 2000 AD from within. See you in 2 weeks' time, Earthlitz. Splendigwerthrig.
Power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at Insta 2000 AD. Program complete. Shutting.